Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you for a Tuesday edition of On My Mind. There is yet to be a thorough investigation into exactly how much Russian influence affected the outcome of the 2016 election. The National Intelligence Community is prohibited from looking into domestic politics, and Congress refuses to take up the cause. So, University of Pennsylvania Professor Kathleen Hall Jamieson decided to fill that void. In a new book, she tries to find out exactly what we do, don't, and may never know. It's titled Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. Dr. Jamieson, it's great to talk to you again.
It's good to be back.
You have a reputation for being extremely nonpartisan, but you have concluded that without Russian interference, Donald Trump would not be president. How sure are you?
I argue that the preponderance of the evidence suggests that. We can't know it with certainty because of all the complexities of studying something that's already taken place, but it's more likely than not. And that conclusion is based on my understanding of how the sorts of activities that changed the media agenda across time affected voters in past elections, and on polling data about what seemed to be effects of media promulgation of Russian hacked content, and my understanding from our past research about what happens when the discourse climate changes because there's more information that's negative about one candidate than the other.
So how much information was there available that leads you to this conclusion?
I make my argument based on the analysis of three different blocks of information. The first is the kind of content, the amount of content, and its strategic alignment with candidate Trump's objectives in the social media. And there I'm talking about the Russian trolls who pretended they were U.S. citizens. They were essentially imposters and created content that resonated potentially with those voters that Donald Trump needed to mobilize. That would be evangelical Christians who were white, as well as conservative Catholics. And secondly, military households, including veterans. If Donald Trump had gotten the percent of that vote that was with him in August, in November, he would not have won the Electoral College. But he does bring that percent up, and there's some troll influence there. They do have messaging in that regard. Secondly, they knew enough to try to demobilize African Americans and Sanders supporters, substantial efforts to do the former. And where they couldn't demobilize, they were also trying to shift those voters so that they wouldn't cast a Clinton vote, they would cast a vote for Jill Stein. So that strategic alignment, coupled with the fact that their messages were consistent with Trump's, anti-immigrant, for example, the same basic attacks on Hillary Clinton, suggests that if they reached the susceptible voters in the three key states, and there I don't know whether they did, because we don't have that needed data from the social media platforms, but if they did, that could have swung the outcome, and that's my first argument. But it's the weakest of my three.
But how were they able to keep, for example, Clinton voters at home?
If you think about the election of 2016, and you and I have talked about elections for a very long time together, it was a very different year. It was different first because the biggest predictor of a vote, which is your identification with a political party, was not as strong as it was in past years because there was a higher percent of the electorate that said it was independent. Those people are more likely to be influenced. But secondly, this was an unusual year because we had very conflicted voters. There were a lot of voters who were approaching their early ballot or approaching election day, and they didn't like either one of the candidates. Now, when you're in a situation in which you're not anchored to your political party, you're an independent, and you don't really like either of the candidates, and you're still undecided in the last month, you're susceptible to influence. Now to your question. How would I encourage, say, an African-American voter to stay home? First, I would increase the likelihood that you're thinking about things that hurt your assessment of Clinton. So I would stress her comment from her earlier career about super predators, a comment that alienated African Americans. And second, I would stress Bill Clinton's record as president, in which there was an increased incarceration of blacks. If those things are more salient to you, even if you don't like Donald Trump and you're likely to support a Democrat if you vote, and there's one more cue, Donald Trump isn't really a menace to you. He's not threatening you. I've increased the likelihood that you stay home.
What about the role of WikiLeaks?
The Russian hackers who stole the Democratic content used three front groups, but the most influential cutout, essentially, was WikiLeaks. And what WikiLeaks essentially accomplished was providing a cover so that the press didn't remember or didn't say, this is Russian stolen content, and didn't say, Julian Assange is the mastermind of WikiLeaks. Now, the reason that's important is that the content that came into our system, into our discourse, illegally gotten by Russians, transferred to us by Julian Assange, lost those two early identifying markers in the press translation. And so instead of saying illegally gotten Russian stolen content, the press said WikiLeaks. Instead of saying given to us by Julian Assange, whom Hillary Clinton wants to prosecute for his misuse of classified information and who actively opposes her, the press said WikiLeaks. The label WikiLeaks made the content more benign, and it legitimized it because it camouflaged the identity of two forces behind it, and in the process, minimized the likelihood that those who saw that label and that content in news would ask, why do the Russians not want to elect Hillary Clinton? Why does Julian Assange not like Hillary Clinton?
So you've mentioned the press several times. What about the entire role of the media?
We are in an interesting environment in which the press is facing rapid change in what is available for it to cover. Fewer resources and more demands to be in more venues than it ever has before. And every time I look at what my students who are in the journalistic community do from dawn to dusk, it all but makes me tired thinking about it. So in that pressured environment, when a large amount of hacked content is dumped on the press, it didn't have the time, nor did it make the time, to consider carefully what it had, determine whether it was accurate, and then use it carefully. And as a result, at key moments, stories get into the press in a way that they would not have had the press been less hurried, less driven by the need to scoop, less likely to try to find the scandal, and more considered and more inclined to say, what's the issue substance here? How does this forecast governance? Is this actually important new information? And we saw that most clearly on October 7th, when the intelligence community certified that the Russians were behind the hacking. Shortly thereafter, on that Friday, October 7th, the Access Hollywood story breaks in the Washington Post with its lewd remarks on tape by Donald Trump, not then yet a candidate. And then shortly thereafter, and this is the important point, WikiLeaks, through Julian Assange, puts Russian-hacked, illegally gotten Podesta content into the news cycle in the form of speech excerpts from those speeches that Bernie Sanders had been seeking throughout the primary and Hillary Clinton had not been disclosing, and those speeches that Donald Trump wanted to see as well. The first thing the press did was dropped story one. We lost track of the Russians as hackers. And the press didn't import that information into its coverage of the Podesta content. Had that content not come into the media stream that day, there would have been two anti-Trump stories dominating the weekend, importantly in the weekend, because that's the weekend of the second debate. The material comes out on the 7th, the debate is the 9th. And so by dropping the Russian hacking and focusing on the Podesta email disclosures against the Access Hollywood tape, the press created a balance between the two that let the Trump campaign argue, as Rudy Giuliani did on all of the Sunday shows, that these are essentially equivalent indications of flawed candidates. In other words, don't use the Access Hollywood tape to discredit Donald Trump.
You ask the question, suppose Donald Trump's emails had been hacked. What might we have seen and understood differently?
The reason for setting up that hypothetical is that we came to accept the WikiLeaked content as if it were simply a legitimate part of the campaign. And there's an interesting question. If the press had uncovered that, would we not have assumed it was a legitimate part of the campaign? It's not that the Clinton people dispute the accuracy, although the press has not used it accurately in the case of the speech text. The Clinton campaign didn't dispute that she said what's in those excerpts. So the question becomes, when you have that content out there, what do you do with it? And when do you say it's just acceptable that we have that? Of course, it's just part of the campaign dialogue. When you do that, you forget that only one side was hacked. Only one side is being strategically leaked. And so my hypothetical, what if someone had hacked Donald Trump Jr.'s email, Michael Flynn's email, Michael Cohen's email, is an attempt to say, what would happen if we equalize the playing field? The difference between the Russians and journalists, if they both were able to hack, and journalists, of course, would not hack because it is an illegal activity, is that the journalists, under my hypothetical, would be equal opportunity hackers, and we would have been more likely to know about, for example, the controversial Trump Tower meeting or those payments that are being made by Michael Cohen to silence women whose stories sound remarkably like actions that are consistent with the person who's speaking in the Access Hollywood tape.
I found it fascinating that Donald Trump himself, on the campaign trail, debating Hillary Clinton, said, go after Hillary Clinton's emails to the Russians. He's addressing them on television.
And that occurs in July 2016. And the most interesting statement to me there, although they are both interesting, the first statement says, Russia, if you're listening, and then find those 33,000 emails. Now, those are the emails that the Clinton staff deleted from the server, arguing that they were personal. And Donald Trump's suspicion is that they deleted some things that, instead of being personal, were simply politically embarrassing and might reveal scandals or even malfeasance. But Donald Trump's second sentence is usually ignored. And he says in the second sentence, if you do that, you will probably be rewarded amply by our press. Now, he's actually right about that. The Russians never found those 33 deleted emails. Or if they did, they didn't disclose them. But the Russian hacked content was amply rewarded by the press throughout the rest of the campaign. So as people fact-checked Donald Trump, he was right about that one.
You actually link James Comey to the Russian campaign to influence the election. Talk about why and how you see that.
Since this analysis is based on material that remains classified, but that we know exists, it is a more tentative and a more complicated analysis. James Comey made, as director of the FBI, an unprecedented move when in July 2016, he stood up and made an extended statement arguing the FBI had been thorough and completely independent of influence. Hillary Clinton had been extremely careless, but he was not going to recommend charging her. And I remember watching that saying, this is odd. Why is he making an extended statement and then saying he's not going to charge her? You'd expect, if he's not going to charge her, that he just simply would file that statement with the originating agency, and there wouldn't be this long statement about how independent they were and thorough they were. Well, it turns out, in later disclosures, Director Comey says that two factors were motivating his decision to go public with that very odd extended public statement. The first, the meeting on the tarmac between Attorney General Loretta Lynch and former President Bill Clinton.
Right.
And the second, classified information he cannot talk about that he assumed could be leaked and could cause, as a result, people to believe that the FBI and Justice Department had not had integrity in this process. Now, enterprising journalists went and looked to see what is this classified information, and they surmised from their sources that it was Russian in origin, that the reason that the FBI was not talking about it was that would disclose methods that they could not, as a result, afford to have released because they would compromise a method or a source, and that it consisted of content that suggested that Attorney General Lynch had told the Democrats that they're really the Clinton investigation would go easy, that basically it wasn't going to be problematic for the Clinton campaign. Now, we presume that that was Russian disinformation because the parties that are mentioned in this exchange don't know each other. And when they know each other, deny that they said this to each other. And if Attorney General Lynch had given that assurance, the Republicans are in control. You would expect that in the Senate and the House, we would have heard about it by now.
Of course.
So presumably it was Russian disinformation. Now, but because the hacked content that the Russians had released through Julian Assange's WikiLeaks had been accurate, a point that Putin has made subsequently, that disinformation put Director Comey in a terrible situation because the Russians had basically put into the system a lot of accurate content. If they leaked this, why wouldn't we assume it was accurate? And secondly, if it was in this polarized environment in which candidate Trump was arguing the election was rigged, if Hillary Clinton became the president, as Director Comey and the polls assumed that she would, then it could be used to discredit her presidency. And so what is Director Comey to do? Suddenly, this makes sense of the strange July statement and the strange October notification of Congress, which we reasonably know will immediately leak, which it does, in which the FBI lets the world know that it's reopening its investigation of the Clinton server because of content found on the Anthony Weiner laptop. So if Director Comey was worried that this disinformation would be used to discredit the FBI in July, I argue he would presumably also have been worried it would have affected perceptions of Clinton's legitimacy as president if the public and the Congress didn't know the investigation had integrity and knew it had happened.
Dr. Jameson, what about Facebook and what information it may have or had which has not yet been released?
The information that I would like to see from all of the affected social media platforms, and we've learned almost month by month that there are new platforms that were affected, is who was reached with the content. We know that they know that. Twitter, for example, notified people who had been exposed to Russian content personally, notified them on their mobile devices, on their laptops, on their computers, that they had been exposed to the content. If we knew the demographics, we don't need to know who they are by name, of the individuals reached in the three states that decided the Electoral College, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, we would know whether the trolls actually did accomplish their intended effect.
Is there a view that you hold that Putin himself might have been directly involved in all of this?
The intelligence agencies have confirmed that this kind of activity and this level of activity would not have happened in the Russian system without authorization at the highest levels. Highest levels, I believe, means Putin.
Indeed.
And if you listen carefully to what he's said across time, first what you see is Putin is a very cagey person.
You bet.
And you see that he has provided hints that the Russians did it. So I put at the very beginning of the book in the prologue just a series of quotes, including quotes by Putin. And one of the final quotes is one in which he seems to tacitly acknowledge the hacking and assumes there's nothing wrong with it because the content was accurate. And so the problem, he suggests, was in the people who weren't being candid and whose lack of candor was revealed by the hacking. And it's one of those wonderful, ironic moments in which you just have to smile and say, I know what you're telling me here. I'm reading between the lines. Putin's defense also that says, no, it's not the Russian government, but it might have been Russian citizens who were offended at the way in which the U.S. has treated Russia are also another hint. And then there's a statement he made to NBC's Megyn Kelly, which basically suggests that the United States has done it to us. You could reasonably expect someone would return the favor. I urge people to take a look at that, those quotes at the beginning of the book, just because I think the narrative of Putin as cagey creature is pretty strong in those quotes.
Kathleen Nahol Jamieson, as always, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And that was University of Pennsylvania Professor Kathleen Nahol Jamieson. Her new book is titled Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Natalie Urev-Lidker and Ben Privett. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.